Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. This is not usually our intro music. That is the lovely voice of our guest, Ellen Zacco, singing Billy Strayhorn. Is that right, Ellen?
That is right. Billy Strayhorn. Yes.
Amazing. Well, I'm Carmen DeVito.
I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and you're listening to We Dig Plants.
Yes, and today Ellen is going to be getting us a little bit tipsy, I think.
Maybe just a little.
We have a live one in the studio today.
Yeah.
But before we get into it with Ellen, and we're going to go deep, we're going to dig deep tonight, we have to do our horticultural honor roll. Jack, take it away. Or Alice, take it away. Oops. Anyway.
Jack, have you had a drink yet?
We haven't.
Yeah, I've been drinking the cocktails here, sorry.
Okay. There we go. Okay.
All right, Alice, the horticultural honor roll.
Our horticultural honor roll of the week is Nicholas Culpepper. And Ellen, I'm sure you know who Nicholas Culpepper is. I'm going to start with a quote from him. "The barks of trees are best gathered in the spring. If it be of great trees, as oaks or the like, because they come easiest off, and so you may dry them if you please, but indeed your best way is to gather all barks only for present use." So let me just tell you a little bit about him. He was born in 1616 and died in 1654. He was the son of a clergyman and an English botanist, herbalist, physician, and astrologer. He's one of the best-known 17th century herbalists in the world, mainly for his writings, and in particular his book, Complete Herbal and English Physician, which gives us an unparalleled view into the holistic principles of the Greco-Arabic medicine. His writings also provide an integration of astrological principles. For many centuries and in his time, astrology was used as standard for the prognosis of disease. So Culpepper showed a much more integrated system in his work, which was not just about disease, but was about plants, and he used astrological attributes to kind of come to know these plants and to find them in his physician's use. So he was a forager. Let's just cut
and
to
that's
the chase.
Why we're honoring him, because and Ellen is more,
Ellen is a forager.
Ellen, and yes, she's much more than that, but she's a writer.
I didn't know about the astrological. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
Part.
Yeah.
I knew about of Nicholas Culpepper. I have his book, but I didn't know about the astrological part.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was, you know, he was of that kind of metaphysical time of scientific discovery. Hmm. So I think it's...
Well,
it's,
I think gardeners have to be a little bit of astrologers too, don't you think?
I don't know anything about astrology. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to disprove your theory. No. Maybe I'm a very bad gardener, but I don't know. You know, I know I'm a Capricorn. There you go. That's all I've got.
Well, let's talk a little bit about today's show, because we have this amazing friend, Ellen Zacos, and we met her at the GWA conference, the Garden Writers Association conference. She's from New York. She is a writer and a teacher and a lecturer. She does interior and exterior installations. She has garden clients. And
she teaches.
She teaches.
And she sings,
and
obviously.
She sings. So we're going to – and so she produced this – amazing CD of songs that we're going to play throughout the show. So Ellen, tell us a little more about how you came to New York.
To horticulture.
It's, you know, when you live here and somebody says, oh, I came to New York to be an actor, you're like, oh, another one.
Which means you're a waitress.
Yes. But instead of being a waitress, yeah. I became a word processor, and then I became a gardener. And I actually started gardening while I was still an actor.
But you're not just an actor. Let's talk about some of the roles that you've played.
I was in the ensemble of Les Mis on Broadway, and I was in the original cast of Falsetto Land at Playwrights Horizon. So those were my two, you know, woohoo.
Claim to fame.
Good job. Yeah. but it was interesting because I had not planned to leave show business, but I started working as a gardener, and I had a second callback for a really good role at the Goodspeed Opera House, and it was an original role, and it was really exciting. And when they called me back for the second callback, instead of saying, oh, I got a second callback, I thought, oh, if I get this job, who's going to take care of the greenhouses? Oh. And that's what I knew. And I said, Michael, I'm leaving show business. And he, knowing me so well, said, could you wait a year, Ellen, before you tell your agents? Because he knew I'd like call them the next day and say, I'm done. And then I'd regret it and I'd be hell to live with. So I did. But that was when I knew it had shifted. I loved plants more than I loved, not necessarily performing, but the life of being an actor.
Right. Right. Yeah. So you've brought in, as we talk today, we're going to be tasting some elixirs.
We are, yeah.
That Ellen has written her most recent book about, Foraging.
Backyard Foraging, yes.
Backyard Foraging. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, Ellen. Tell us about the new book.
Well, it's called Backyard Foraging, 65 Familiar Plants You Didn't Know You Could Eat.
Right.
Because my ploy for getting more people interested in foraging is to start them in a non-scary way, because so many people are afraid, oh, I'll eat something that I'm going to poison myself and my family. But if you start out in your own backyard with a hosta or a daylily or something that you absolutely know what it is, it takes the fear factor out of it.
Right.
So it's called Backyard Foraging because I swear, well, you guys, of course, would know all of these plants, but almost anybody would recognize most of these plants to begin with. And so it makes it safe and easy. And if they like it, they can take it up a notch.
Right.
So that's the idea.
Yeah, because it is very intimidating. I mean, you go out into the woods and you think you know what it is, but there's so many plants that mimic each other. It looks so similar. And
you know, just yesterday I was out, I was telling you before I got scored some crab apples. They were really good. And I saw a shrub and I was like, is that aronia? I don't know. If it's aronia, I want those berries. But it was too tall for an aronia, and the trunk just didn't look right, and the bark just didn't look right, and I thought, nope, not picking them.
Yeah.
And also, not just novices, but even experienced gardeners, plants look different at different stages of their development.
Yep, right.
I always amaze the novice gardeners that sometimes work with us. I'll say, look at that plant. What do you think it is? And they're like, it kind of looks like ivy, but it doesn't have the pointy, the three pointy lobes.
Yeah.
And it looks like a very different plant.
Yeah.
As a mature specimen versus juvenile.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And then to make it even more complicated, you've got identical plants at identical stages of development growing in very different conditions. So you've got one growing in the shade and it's got these long internodes and these big floppy leaves, and you've got one growing in the sun and it's much more compact, and you know, it's complicated.
Yeah. And how many of us have gotten poison ivy because we didn't recognize it in its not typical form?
Well, you know,
even when you do know what it is, you just forget it, you know,
and poison ivy can look so different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But let me go back to the backyard idea, because I was actually, a couple of weeks ago, we had another gentleman on, Michael Heim from Boulder, who's a forager. And he's in the woods talking about foraging and morels and, you know, he's doing some exotic stuff. But you're talking about the backyard. Mm-hmm. So as I was doing research for his show, I just was like typing in different Google searches. And rhododendrons, that's a very common backyard plant. Mm-hmm. Hydrangeas, that's a very common. How did you come up with the list? I mean, obviously you're not picking poisonous plants, but
like rhododendrons.
Like rhododendrons, right. But like, you know, if you want to get somebody excited about backyard foraging, your book is very necessary.
And taste. We have taste was a big factor, Ellen, right?
It is, because I am not interested in survival food. And I make that very clear.
Woo, I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
If it doesn't, if it, you remember how I really love...
do you want to say it?
I said earlier, I'd do anything for a good meal. I didn't mean it.
I think you're not the first person on my station to make that statement.
I if it weren't delicious, I wouldn't be interested, and I would not waste your time.
Right.
Okay. I would not waste your time. And one of the things, you know, when I lecture on this topic a lot, and today I've brought you not foraged things to eat, but foraged things to drink, because I am very fond of beverages.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, solid food.
Uh-huh.
And when I give my lectures and I start mentioning the alcoholic beverages, people laugh like they think I'm kidding. And I'll say, and this one tastes really good with rum, and this one is great with vodka. And they like, I'm joking. I'm not joking.
Yeah.
Well, so you had to taste testing then, Ellen, on these.
On these. I spent my entire weekend devising these recipes. I had to do a lot of serious research for you gals.
Okay, so let's get to work. Okay. What's the first drink that we're going to have today?
All right, the first one that we're going to make, I think I need to move this a little bit.
Yes.
Hopefully you can still hear me.
Yep.
I'm going to put some ice in a shaker.
Cocktails with Ellen.
Yes. The first one is called a Dirty Lily Bud.
Dirty Lily Bud.
Yeah. And
that's very...
it's kind of evocative, isn't it?
It's evocative. Yeah. It's a little... Lilies are known for their symbolic purity.
Now,
right? That's what I love about this Dirty Lily Bud.
Well, this is made with my favorite gin. And I actually do work for the company, so I might have to tell you that.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's called The Botanist, and it's owned by Remy.
Right.
And they... this gin is made in Scotland, and it's based on 22 foraged plants that are on the island. So it's really got many more complicated flavors than most gin.
And they sent you flew you out to Scotland.
They did
forage with the
to meet the foragers.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. Now I'm going to make noise here.
That's all right.
While I shake.
This is a food network.
So this is a very, very simple drink. This is basically just the Botanist gin and a pickled daylily bud. And like in a dirty martini, you know how you'd put in some of the olive juice? It's some of the pickling brine from the daylily bud.
Okay. Okay.
Now, I would never have thought to eat a daylily.
I would never have thought to pickle a daylily.
Oh, well. Yeah. I'll leave the pickles here. You can try the pickles. I brought the whole jar of pickles. Now, I am not a martini person, but I love this drink. But it's basically all booze, so pace yourselves.
Okay. See, let me preface by we had a bunch of pizza before we ate.
Yeah.
So. I'm not sure if that really helps.
All right. I'm going
to
go down.
I've passed the drink to Alice. I'm going to pass the pickles to Carmen.
I'm going down with the Dirty Lily Bud right now.
Okay. I'm going to taste this. Ooh, how interesting.
That is
awesome.
Oh,
my God. What is this pickled with, Ellen?
I pickled those daylily buds with, and this is all from my backyard. You like it?
Oh, my God.
Wow. Okay. It's amazing.
I'll pass it to Carmen before I take a sip. It's got spice bush berries and some native ginger root from the Acerum canadense.
Uh-huh.
And bay leaf, Pennsylvania bay. And then I did put in a hot pepper that I actually grew, but not buried.
Okay. Good so stuff. In your book, do you have recipes?
I do have recipes, not quite as many as I would like.
Uh-huh.
But I hope that what I'm trying to do now is pitch a book that's all recipes.
Yeah.
So we'll see. There are some recipes in the book.
It's really good.
You like it?
Now, there's a sweetness to it that is surprising.
Yeah.
To the drink?
To the drink, but more so to the pickle.
Well, you know,
the bud.
Pickle? I didn't taste sweetness in that drink.
This is strong.
Yeah.
I mean, this is some sweetness in there. Yeah.
Can you pass that back to me, Ellen?
Okay. You know, there is sugar in the pickling brine. It's vinegar, water, sugar.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I think you can really taste the ginger. Here's some of the ginger stolen.
Delicious. And the texture of the daylily, I like the texture as well. It's not quite like an olive, but it's a perfect texture for a drink.
It's got a little bit of crunch.
Yeah.
And you definitely get the heat in there when you eat it from the hot pepper.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up drinking Fernet Branca. Do you know what that is?
I do.
Now that is...
Oh, man.
I've had that at your dad's house.
And also chinar. You know that other aperitif chinar made from
artichokes.
Yes. So we grew up, my parents dosed us with this. Oh, you have a stomach ache? You're going to have some Fernet Branc.
Seriously?
Yes.
That's what they were giving you?
And you're bugging the bejesus out of me?
And that stuff is the, now it's become all the rage, right? You know, all these different like elixirs and aperitifs. It is the bitterest thing. One of the bitterest things I've ever tasted. You've tasted it, Alice.
Yes. It's lovely.
This is good gin. Thank you.
Yeah, it's very good gin, too.
And it was the botanist gin that got my attention.
Well, that's right. The first time we communicated.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, we've got to talk about this botanist gin.
Yeah. I love this gin. And I swear I would say that even if I didn't have a relationship with the company, because
no, it's delicious.
It's delicious. Yeah. It's got such complexity.
It's drinkable. Mm-hmm. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So in this drink is the gin, mm-hmm. a little bit of the pickling brine,
mm-hmm. and a pickle.
That's it.
Yeah.
Really?
It's so a sipping drink. I mean, that's a strong drink.
Yeah.
But it's so.
And I don't like martinis either.
No. But it feels it's cool and refreshing.
I think part of that is because there are so many botanicals in the gin itself.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like you're drinking gin.
Now, gin usually has botanicals in it, Ellen.
It does. There are 9 core botanicals that are usually
in
gin.
Can you tell us what they are?
I cannot tell you what they are. I can tell you that they include, but are not limited to, things like, you know, juniper berry and orris root and stuff like that.
Right.
But then this gin includes other things like water mint and gorse and artemisias and a lot of other stuff that grows on the island.
And you were able to watch the process of it. Do they ferment any of these? How does it work? Tell me about the distilling process of this.
It's really interesting because they have the only, and you can stop me if it's too much, they have the only Lomond pot still left in existence, and it's a really slow distillation rate. It distills at like 3 times slower than most gin is distilled. Oh, I feel so parched. Let me have a sip. Alice.
It goes down smooth, I'll tell you that.
So what they do is they distill the liquid in the pot of the still with the 9 core botanicals.
Okay.
And then they built a basket in the top of the still to hold the 22 herbs, which have been collected at different times of the year, and so they're stored dried.
Uh-huh.
They go in the basket, and when the liquid is heated, it evaporates, it goes up the neck of the still, passes through the basket with the dried herbs, condenses, and comes back down.
Okay.
And that's how the flavors from the dried herbs get into the gin.
Oh, that's interesting. And so there's a kind of a two-step process. There are herbs that are used fresh in the...
They're
always dry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. First of all, because the flavors are more concentrated. Yeah, and second of all, because... You can't get, you know, if you're going to be doing a batch of gin every 8 weeks, you can't necessarily get everything fresh when you need it. So they do.
That makes sense. Yeah. And it is more concentrated. That's amazing. So did you go out into the fields and forage with them?
Yes, it was a very rainy day.
Of course.
But they were well prepared. We got soaking wet, but we found a lot of interesting stuff.
So how did you come to meet them and how, like, what, this is a dream job.
I know. It's a dream job.
Yeah.
Yeah. They found my book, Backyard Foraging.
Okay.
And they contacted me that way, and they said one of the things that they looked at a lot of different people's books, but I had the most booze recipes in there.
Well, that's great.
So they thought I was their people.
Girl,
yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book.
Okay.
65 Plants.
And you just tell me when you're ready for the next cocktail, because, you know.
Yeah. I think keep mixing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So some of the plants that you highlight in your book, dogwood, rose, oak, juniper, we've just had some daylily. Tell us what you do. What do you do with dogwood? I think everybody grows that plant.
It is so interesting that you ask, because just yesterday I was picking the Coosa dogwood fruit from my Coosa tree.
Which is a beautiful fruit.
Which is a beautiful fruit. But nobody knows you can eat it.
Right.
Well, not nobody, but a lot of people don't know you can
eat
it.
Maybe I'll make a Coosa pie this weekend.
It doesn't cook well. It's, you know, and I've tried it. It loses a lot of its flavor when it's
heated.
Okay. But raw, it is absolutely delicious. You know how it's got that sort of alligatory skin?
Yeah.
I need to wipe this shaker out or rinse it. I'm sorry, it's got the daylily stuff in it.
Ah, yes.
Thank you. It's got that alligatory skin, so you just kind of hold it in one hand and you squeeze the flesh out into your mouth.
Okay.
And it's got three or four seeds, which you'll want to spit out.
Uh-huh.
But it's a delicious, delicious fruit, and it's got this bright orange flesh.
Uh-huh.
So one of my favorite things to do, thank you, is get them out, the flesh out of the skin, run it through a food mill, get uh-huh. the seeds out, and then you serve it like an applesauce you would next to like a pork roast or something
uh-huh.
like that.
Oh.
Except because it's got that same fresh taste and it's sweet, but it's a beautiful color
uh-huh.
and it's got great texture. But it's a very different flavor from the apple. The color looks wonderful next to the pork, and the flavors combine really well. So that's my favorite way.
Okay.
To eat it.
Okay, let's talk about oak.
Well,
I mean, other than the obvious of.
But that's what it is. It's
okay.
the obvious. It's the acorns.
Right.
You know, and that's a lot of work. But I honestly think that no forager really feels like they're a forager until they've collected acorns and processed them and,
yeah.
and made stuff. And this is one of my favorite things. If you can process acorns either cold or hot processing. And the stories tell of how the Native Americans would put their baskets of acorns in the fast-moving stream and it would leach the tannins from the acorns. Well, we don't have those fast-moving streams.
No. And they're filthy and you don't want to put your hands
right.
in them.
So you have to find alternatives. And the reason you do is because if you hot process acorns, you can't then use it for flour because it
yes.
won't bind.
Uh-huh.
You can use it as nuts, but sometimes you like to make bread. So I use a toilet. And when I say this to people, they're like, you put the acorns in the toilet. I'm like, not in the toilet bowl, in the toilet tank.
Right.
Where it's clean water. Drain the toilet tank, wash it out.
Right.
And then just tie the acorns in a jelly bag in the back of the toilet tank.
And every time you flush.
Every time you flush, water goes through. And two or three days later, your acorns are going to be completely leached.
Interesting.
Not bitter anymore. And they will be, you know, you're not using any extra water, any extra energy,
yeah.
just what you would normally use.
Right.
And then you can use it as flour because it will actually bind.
Otherwise, it cannot. It tastes pretty bitter.
Yeah, very bitter. Very bitter.
Without,
So, Rose, Carmen and I once went to a Persian restaurant
yes.
in Boston. Actually, you might know this. You're from Boston.
I'm from New Hampshire.
From New Hampshire, but you went to school in Boston.
Yes.
We went to this amazing Persian restaurant. We were there for a conference, and I'll never, ever forget the rose water.
It flavors a lot of things in Persian food.
Dessert.
We
had a flan or something, and I will never forget that. Tell us about your...
I'm going to disappoint you now.
Okay.
Because I like the rose hips.
Okay.
That's what I mean,
yeah.
rose petals are edible as
yeah.
long as they haven't been sprayed with anything.
Right.
Any rose petal is edible. And
right.
the more fragrant, the better.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, I spilled some. Oh. But what I like is the hips. And I like the big hips. So it's either the rugosa roses or the dog roses. And they've got a ton of vitamin C. And they can be actually sweet and very juicy. But inside, and you've probably cut open a rose hip before, they've a lot of seeds, and they're all covered with these hairs, which were actually the original itching powder that you used to see advertised in the back of comic books. So you don't want to eat that part. And that's why you like working with the big ones, because you can slice it open and just scoop out stuff. And you can imagine if you were using little rose hips.
Right, right.
That would be tedious. But there's a rose hip soup. I have to keep making this cocktail while I talk.
Okay. Rose hip soup
that is a traditional dish in Eastern Europe and in Scandinavia, and it's called. I can't. Is anybody Swedish here?
No.
It's something like nipponzoppa.
Okay.
And it's really interesting. I love it. It can be served hot or cold. You can like put a swirl of yogurt into it or cream, and it's kind of fruity and kind of vegetal at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like to tell people is if you want to experiment with the taste before you make the soup, you can actually go to IKEA and buy a bottle of rose hip drink. They sell it in their store.
Oh, okay.
There. So,
well, I've had rose hip tea, and rose hips are usually included in dried, some herbal, I've seen it in Eastern European herbal teas and tisanes, and I love mm-hmm. that. It does have, you're right, Ellen, it does have a sort of syrupy sweetness,
mm-hmm.
kind of concentrated, and it's a really good, it's a good flavor.
Yeah.
So what are we drinking now?
Well, I'm not going to tell you until you taste it, and then Carmen has to taste
okay,
it.
Okay, this is the surprise.
Yeah. This is the butterfly kiss. which there's a
I have just been kissed by a butterfly.
There's a clue in the name.
All right, I'm
covering up the writing on the jar.
It's a beautiful, beautiful, sweet pink color.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do the monarch butterflies like?
Asclepius.
Asclepius.
Yes.
And vodka?
Yes. This is vodka and a milkweed simple syrup.
Oh.
With just a splash
milkweed
of tonic.
Simple syrup.
Yeah, from the ripe. You can use the milkweed is my favorite edible plant. You can eat the young stems. You can eat the flower buds before they open. You can eat the young pods.
Uh-huh.
And the flowers when they're fully open and dripping with nectar.
Yeah,
make this beautiful pink.
Wow,
it's quite brighter than that, but that's diluted with the vodka.
That is amazing.
That is the best drink I've ever had. you need to patent that drink. That drink is amazing.
It's tasty, isn't it?
No wonder the butterflies love
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
wow,
it's a nice one. I'll just have to take a sip as it's going back down.
That
here.
Is.
I was going to say Budleia, but I couldn't imagine Budleia producing.
No.
Anything tasty.
No.
You know?
And
the pods aren't.
Yeah. And the flowers are not succulent. The way milkweed flowers really are juicy and they produce a lot of nectar.
So you, how do you make the simple syrup?
I put a bunch of flowers in a small pan and.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Oh.
Cover them just barely with water.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're doing a simple syrup. I used to really minimize the amount of sugar I would use because mm-hmm. I didn't want it to be too sweet.
Uh-huh.
But when I started working with mixologists, they taught me so much. I want to become a bartender now. Because it's so interesting. I mean, if you love to cook, it's a whole new, and they said, I was bringing them like a spruce tip simple syrup and all these simple syrups. And they're like, well, how much sugar did you use? This isn't sweet enough. And they told me that when you're working with alcohol, if you don't have a simple syrup that's basically a one-to-one, it just, the flavors don't come together right.
Mm-hmm.
So I started making my simple syrups now really, you know, one part water to one part sugar. So that's what this is.
Right. And it's diluted very much between the ice and the mixer.
Oh, yeah.
So there, you don't need much.
And it doesn't taste, I mean, it's a sweet drink, but I don't think it's an overly sweet drink.
No.
It's good. I'm going to have a little more.
You go right ahead. But save room for the grand finale.
Ellen, can we get these recipes and post them?
Oh, yeah.
On our Facebook fan
page? I will
page?
Send them to you. Absolutely.
Alrighty.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
This is really awesome. We have to take a break.
Okay.
Hang on. We're going to mix another drink and listen to some music. We're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
Fate misguided, a buttercup resided in the mandarin's orchid garden. A buttercup that did not grace the loveliness of such a place. And so it simply shriveled up and begged each orchid's pardon. Poor little buttercup in the orchid garden.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
That sound. Welcome back to We Dig Plants. Now, you usually don't hear
shake,
that
shake,
sound.
Shake.
That is the sound of a cocktail shaker. We're here with Ellen Sackos, writer, gardener,
Forager, drink maker,
chanteuse. Ellen, what was the name of the song that we just played?
In the Mandarin Orchids.
Oh, and who was the songwriter on that?
Oh, don't ask me. Oh. I'm making a drink. Is it Roger?
It was
Roger
Hammerstein.
It might have been Rogers and Hammerstein, or it might have just been Hammerstein. I'm
it
not
was
sure.
Incredible, and the way that it was arranged, and the guitar in the beginning, is just beautiful.
There's a lot of layers here today with Ms. Zacharis. Yes.
I could stay and drink and talk. Okay,
so Ellen is mixing up our third drink.
Yes.
She's going to surprise us, right? Another surprise?
Another
or do you want to talk about this?
The name kind of gives this one away, so I'll just tell you what this is. This is a Japanese knotweed whiskey sour.
Okay, right.
And
you found something useful with Japanese knotweed?
I love Japanese knotweed. I make wine from Japanese knotweed. Uh-huh. You can use it as a rhubarb substitute. In cooking.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And these are homemade bitters that
okay.
I made. This is a sumac, dandelion, spice bush, artemisia bitters.
Wow. Beautiful looking. It's like an amber color.
Yeah. What I learned from, this is a traditional whiskey sour, which has the raw egg white in it.
Okay, right.
Which has kind of fallen out of favor, but shouldn't have. But some people are nervous about
raw eggs.
Oh,
those health nuts.
Yes.
Cheers.
What I learned from the mixologist that I've been working with is that raw egg whites, if they sit for like 5 minutes, start to smell like wet dog. They're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But if you put bitters on them, it doesn't.
It. So it's the sulfur.
I don't know.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Really good. It tastes like a whiskey sour, but better.
I think this is maybe my favorite of all of them.
Really,
I know you liked
the
milkweed one, but and this is made from. See, people don't use single malt whiskeys.
Oh my God, this is so creamy and delicious!
I'm so glad you like it.
This is like a snowy evening.
Oh,
this is amazing.
It is. It's like a good fall drink, isn't it? And I think that egg on it really—it
makes
the
a difference.
Egg.
Yeah. Because the fake whiskey sours that you get at a lot of
bars—they're
horrible. Yeah. They're so saccharine tasting.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, it was actually like, oh,
whiskey sour. No, but the whiskey. This is not the whiskey sour of our mothers in the 70s.
No.
But you know, the other thing is that I made this. I made this with a fine single malt whiskey.
Yeah. You can taste the difference.
It's made by it's called Brook Laddie, but it's spelled as if it's Brick Laddick.
Okay.
And this is their organic single malt, and it's one of the lightest of their whiskeys, and it's not peaty.
Yes.
That's exactly it. That's why I like it, because I'm not a whiskey drinker.
Yeah, I am. I am a big whiskey drinker.
Yeah.
And there are many that I would not use in a cocktail, but I was fooling around with this recipe. I tried it with bourbon. I tried it. I'm telling you, the research was exhausting.
Yeah. But, tough job.
But this, it just had such a light, clean flavor to it. And I thought it really, it played well with the knotweed, with the lemoniness.
Yes.
And Yeah.
And so, it doesn't burn your throat going down.
It does not
because
burn.
Of its lightness. And you mentioned peat.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk botanically a little bit about peat and how that relates to whiskey making.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
While we're in Scotland.
All
in
right.
Ireland. While we're in the...
So the peating is done, and some whiskeys are peated and some are not. And the whiskeys that are done in the Speyside area of Scotland, the north central part of the island, are generally not very heavily peated. And generally, the Islay whiskies and the ones off the west coast are more heavily peated. But there's some back and forth. I mean, there's some that are peated from different areas. And when it's after the grain has been sprouted and dried, or maybe it's when it's drying, they don't actually add peat to the grain, but they dry it over a peat fire. And the smoke from the peat goes up through the grains in the drying kiln.
Smoke gets in its eyes.
Yes.
And that gives it its pretty distinctive
smokiness. And whiskeys are graded by, you know, parts per how much peat parts per million. So
really?
You can have some that are very, like Lagavulin is a very heavily peaty, and Brook Laddie actually makes one called Octomore that's the most heavily peated Scotch. It's too heavy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I love Scotch, but you know, I like some peat, but not a lot of peat.
Okay.
And botanically speaking, can you tell our audience what is peat? I mean, people know it from a horticultural perspective as a soil conditioner, as, you know, something that comes from Canada and is used to mix.
I think of it as warming homes.
And that's when you're on Islay in Scotland, you see people by the side of the road digging their own peat to take it home to burn. Yeah. And it's vegetable matter that has been compressed for years and years and years. It's very, you know, it's dense.
Right.
And it's taken home and it's dried out. It's cut. They have these special cutting tools that cut these like bricks. And it's dried out. And then that's burned as fuel in a fireplace or in a stove. And I think, you know, if you left that there, maybe in millions of years, it would turn to coal. But at this point, it's very compressed, very dense, and it's a good fuel.
And it smells lovely, though.
I've never smelled burning peat.
I spent some time in Ireland, and you'll never forget the smell.
No, I love
the specific smell.
It's very specific.
And obviously, there isn't a lot of hardwood forest there, so they don't have that option for using it for fuel. So peat is the natural...
Native. And very few people still dig their own peat, but I actually met a guy when I was there in Islay who worked at the distillery who does dig his own peat. He just, you know, that's what he does. He's very self-sufficient, and it can still be done.
Wow. That drink that you just made would make me an alcoholic. Honest to God, I could drink it.
I think it's superbly delicious.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I like the bird. I think my favorite... I'm torn, though.
The butterfly kiss?
The butterfly kiss is like... Summer that just left.
Nobody likes the dirty lily bud.
But the dirty lily bud is what starts the summer.
Yes.
Like that is the quintessential beginning of summer. You know, put down your gin and tonic. Like move over gin and tonic. Let's have the dirty lily bud. And then
the dirty lily bud reminds me of, okay, it's fall. The lilies are... I'm thinking of the seed pods, you know, it's kind of like the end and it's a little sour and I'm a little upset that summer's over and it's getting dark.
Oh, really?
So, you know, to me, the whiskey sour is fall. I don't know why.
Yeah the whiskey sour is, to me, the lily bud was the beginning.
Spring.
Just because of lily and the...
bud. Because these are the unopened buds.
Yes. Right. And as a matter of fact, we did drink them in the seasonal order. We started with I didn't do that on purpose. We started with lily bud to the milkweed flower.
Yes.
Well, actually, no, because the Japanese knotweed in there is...
Summer weed?
It's the earliest. It's like in mid-April. So, okay, I lied. That should have been the first one. But
we're not slurring our words yet. So, we're all right. So, Ellen, let's talk. You said you did a lot of research and experimentation to get us
these three drinks.
Now, I always like to hear about people's
failures. You're going to ask me about my failures.
Now, it's something that you really wanted to be good and edible, but disappointed you.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, but not necessarily for mixology.
No,
okay,
just generally.
Good, yeah. Yes, there are several things. My worst experience has been with evening primrose, which is a root crop. And, you know, when you're a forager, you're always looking for good root crops because that's a lot of starch and that's a lot of nutrition. And my favorite is Apios americana, which I use as an ornamental in my garden clients. It's a wisteria relative that has gorgeous flowers and a delicious tuber. But evening primrose is a common weed, and if you can make that, it's supposed to be very tasty. It's all over the place. And I love it when you can eat things that are invasive or really, really common, because then you're not endangering anything. And I don't know if I didn't cook it right, but it's the only time I've ever gotten sick. And it was a wretched, you know, on the bathroom floor kind of a night. I am gonna try it again.
Yeah.
Because I just need to make sure that maybe it's an allergy. Maybe, but the friend that I had dinner with that last night, that same night, who ate the evening primrose, had no problem with them whatsoever.
Okay,
that's interesting. Is that the primrose oil that's used medicinally? Is it from the same species?
It's the same. Yes, I think it's Oenothera speciosa.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the tuber or the root is what you eat, and I don't know if they get the oil from the foliage or from the root. I'm not sure.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because you're interested in foraging, right? You get Ellen's book. You're in your backyard. You're in your neighbor's yard. Still, even with this, you're armed with this book. It's a leap of faith to test and try, you know, something that could possibly, like you said, this could be just an allergy.
Yeah.
And these are not things that are normally eaten by any means.
Well, and that's why I always say, when you taste a new food, whether it's the first time you've eaten pinion nuts or strawberries, or the first time that you've eaten evening primrose root. Start with a little bit.
Yes.
Right.
You know, some people, daylily tubers are also edible. Some people have an allergic reaction to daylily tubers.
Uh-huh.
Some people can't digest chicken of the woods mushrooms.
Right.
Well,
right.
I have no problems with any of those foods. Some people, when they're picking ginkgo nuts and they're taking the seed out, get a rash on their hands.
Right.
I don't know any, my personal, but everybody's right. different. Everybody yeah. has different sensitivities. So
right.
you have to start. And in my book, anytime there's something where I've heard of people having a problem, I've put that in the text.
Right, right.
Because, you know, I want
fiddlehead
people to...
Fiddlehead ferns.
Exactly.
Everybody loves, you know, fiddlehead ferns and ramps. Like, mm-hmm. these are the, you know, this is becoming
these are the poster children of foraging.
Of foraging, yeah. right. Yeah. So I remember eating fiddlehead ferns, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I first came to New York. I had an interesting foodie friend who made me this amazing dinner. And it was the first time I had fiddlehead ferns, and I loved them. And in doing research for today's show, Ellen, I looked up fiddlehead ferns. And then instantly up came this paper from the New England Journal of Medicine, the possible side effects of eating brackish fern.
But that's not so, that's not the fiddlehead.
No.
But it is.
But if you don't know.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Mm-hmm. How
similar are fern fiddleheads?
Right.
right? And well, are all edible?
They're not all edible, and they're not all tasty. And
right.
and the bracken fern has a very, very different looking fiddlehead from right. the traditional fiddlehead. So anybody who had eyes that worked would see the difference. It's like right. saying the difference between that cocktail shaker and this canning jar. They
right.
look totally different.
Right.
But the fact is that a lot of cultures eat bracken fern.
Uh-huh.
I've eaten bracken fern.
Uh-huh.
And it's all about the dosage. And with the bracken fern, the idea is, oh gosh, I can't pronounce this name. I wrote it down. Okay, I'm still going to get it wrong. It's something like talquilicide is the active ingredient, and it makes up a big part of it. It's like almost 10% by dry weight, and this is the carcinogen. But the fact is that it's two things. First of all, it's water soluble, and second of all, it's very volatile at room temperature. So what the Japanese and the Korean cooks do is they soak them in cool water to uh-huh. keep them crunchy in several changes of cool water, and that gets rid of a lot of it.
Okay.
And then when you blanch it, if you blanch it in salty water and then shock it in an ice bath, you make it almost harmless. And I say almost because it depends on how much you eat.
Right.
If you're eating it every day in your bim bim bop, you're going to get a lot of it. But if you're eating it a couple times a year because it's in season,
yeah.
it's totally fine. And
right.
in the end, you do what you're comfortable with.
Yes.
You eat what you're comfortable with, and I don't want to force anybody to eat anything.
No.
Right.
But it's just like, you know, I don't normally have three cocktails in the middle of the day. I wouldn't do it every day.
Yeah. Right.
I wouldn't eat the fern every day.
Right.
But in moderation, I honestly believe it's fine.
Right, right.
I agree. Absolutely. I grew up eating purslane.
Yeah,
now it's
yeah.
become, it's like on every menu.
Yeah.
And we ate it in season. It was seasonal because it's a seasonal weed. It's mm-hmm. available only certain times, summertime. And we had it, my mother would pick it out of her garden amongst the tomatoes and basil. We had purslane, celery, red onion, and tomato salad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot in the summer.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was gone. And that's the beauty of foraging as well, Ellen.
It is.
Is that it is so different from the way our food is usually made available to us.
Right.
You know, and that's the beauty of doing the seasonal thing and picking the elderberries when they're ripe and then turning them into simple syrup or whatever concentrate and saving them and savoring them.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it connects you to your place and to your time
yeah.
in a way that nothing else does, because you can't go to the store and buy these things.
Right.
You
no.
have to pick them when they're at their prime. And that's also, you know, that means you're getting their peak flavor and you're preserving those. And it's a wonderful thing.
And it's great to hear that about forage foods as well, because there's so much talk now about, you know, heirloom vegetables, heirloom fruits, heirloom animals,
right.
you know, but
right.
this is something that's even more ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, it comes and it goes far too quickly.
Well, and also just think about the added medicinal benefits that these plants, these nutrients that you don't normally get in your diet, all of a sudden you're adding these amazing vitamins and minerals in.
And I'm not a medicinal plant person. Right. I don't know that, but I do know that, you know, so many of the vegetables that we buy have been bred for long shelf life or shipability.
Right, and it's all been stripped clean.
That nutritionally, a lot of these things that we're foraging
are powerhouses.
They really are.
Right. And they found, I just recently read as well, I think it might have been on NPR, that the flavor molecules in the heirloom go together with the now it's escaping me having a brain freeze
with the flavor heirloom of the heirloom animal.
Yeah. Right. We'll have to come back
heirloom,
to that.
Heirloom.
I think I've had too many cocktails. Oh,
not enough.
Well, Ellen, we're kind of getting to the close of our show, but tell us some other exciting things that you're working on.
Well, I'm getting ready to teach some more forage mixology classes around the country. And I'm currently, can I say this? I'm looking for foragers. Can I say which cities I'm looking
for? Yes.
I'm looking for foragers in Washington, D.C., in Denver, in Chicago, Dallas, and L.A., and Seattle. So if anybody out there is listening, wants to work with me, go to the
We Dig Plants
Facebook page.
Boulder.
Okay.
This forager
Please,
in Boulder.
Oh, yes. You mentioned him. Yeah. So that's where I'll be going next year to teach these forage mixology workshops. And now that I'm especially pleased with how much you like the whiskey sour. So I'm going to have to suggest that one.
That is, I could drink that every night. It's amazing.
Yes. It's dangerously good.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
So what is your email? Plug yourself.
My email is easy@acmeplant.com.
Okay.
And my professional Facebook page is The Backyard Forager. So if you go there, you can find me. If you have any foraging questions, please ask them. Oh, and I'm the new foraging expert for about.com. I forgot to tell you that.
Ah, excellent.
Awesome. So that's just foraging.about.com. And I got lots of recipes and foraging articles posted there as well.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Well, Ellen, we knew it was awesome meeting you at the GWA conference. Of course, being New Yorkers, we've heard your name, you know, in and among all the plant societies. And it was lovely to meet you, but it was more lovely to sit and have drinks with you today.
It was great. This was so much fun. Thank you both.
What a fun life you have.
Well, thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Keep on gardening. We'll see you in the garden.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.